Enterprise. Cosmic Cubbies arrived. 12 transmission steel bars and seats where science, myth, and magic meet. From 61 into the 70, exponential growth only in humanity. I'm a vagabond.
It's incredible.
I'm a vagabond. I'm a vagabond.
Stellar. Fantastic.
I'm a vagabond.
Oh, it's
hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is May 1968. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, I screwed up last week.
Which way?
Well, we had a brilliant guest on the show, the longtime artist of My Little Pony, writer of the amazing new Image comic Stray Dogs, just a total wonderful human being all the way around. I didn't double check the pronunciation of his name before the show. I was just going based off of what I had heard someone introduce him as. And I introduced him as Tony Fleeks. But letter C has two different sounds it can make. And he actually pronounces his name Tony Fleece. And he was too polite to correct me during the recording. But I felt terrible about it all week. I'm just going to try to turn the page on it and try to put that to rest.
He seems nice enough that he might forgive us. And we could maybe, I don't know if Ibrahim said it wrong, but let's just blame Ibrahim.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw Ibrahim under the bus. Yeah. I think that's the best solution. Turning the page, we got a show to do this week. We have another amazing guest on the program. He is a returning favorite. He's a real gem of a human being. The fourth and final volume of his crime series, November, just came out a couple of weeks ago.
Allegedly.
Marvel fans know him as the writer of Fantastic Four, The Immortal Iron Fist, Uncanny X-Men, The Mighty Thor, Invincible Iron Man, of course, Hawkeye. Mark Farkshon, thank you so much for joining us for a third time here on Marvel by the Month.
I am joining in protest because on the list of books released in May 1968 that we are talking about, we are not talking about Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 4. I suspect there are good reasons we're not talking about it, but I'm protesting anyway because I'm surly.
Fair enough. Lockdown has got us all on edge.
Let me pitch this to the group real quick.
Yeah.
Is there any, I think it's maybe, if not the most iconic sort of Marvel cover, it's definitely top three.
Yes.
I was sitting here thinking like I think it's probably Fantastic Four 1, Amazing Fantasy 15, and this.
Well, I mean, like they used it for the cover of a trade paperback.
Yeah, it's been spoofed endlessly and homaged and yet we're not talking about that.
But we're not talking about it.
Not for a long while, but we'll talk. We'll talk about it for a second.
Yeah, I mean, technically, we have talked about it right now. So
I do also think that the punchline is Stranko did not do the issue.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's his most famous cover, not his fucking shit.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a pretty good issue. But yeah, so that's the first. I'm trying to imagine the excitement of seeing that cover for the first time, picking it up on the stand and being like, oh shit, it begins the first of Strango didn't do it this month. Like it's, I believe his first missing of a deadline made it 3 issues. And,
yep. Yes.
But then kind of brilliantly, this is the first issue from the bad guy's POV, which is kind of a brilliant, I'm going to dance between the raindrops without screwing up what you're doing. Like clearly he had a fiefdom and it was being protected story-wise. And you know, Roy Thomas certainly acquitted himself admirably, I thought.
Sure.
Frank Springer, not Steranko, but like that's not a bad looking book.
Yeah. Like Marvel Unlimited doesn't have it. It's not part of the Masterworks collection for S.H.I.E.L.D. either.
But it is available for purchase digitally. So you can spend your $2 and read this on the Marvel app, but it's not on Marvel Unlimited. So
yeah.
You could also just steal it off the internet. Like,
That's
the funniest thing Mark Miller ever said on the internet: every day is free comic book day.
I just had to make sure that Roy Thomas is going to get his 8 cents worth of royalties or whatever from my $2 purchase. So
I've bought it in every other goddamn format. I might not have the, it's precipitous time to have this cover on the stand. It's May 1968. Of course it is. Look at this cover.
This is why we know what 1968 is. It's things like this cover. Yeah.
The only thing better would be like those cards with the little chip in it that plays music when you open them. Like if you opened it, if like Inagata DeVita would start playing.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming back.
When are we going to start rolling?
Yeah, eventually. About an hour ago. What's up? How's everything going with House Diffraction? You have a new puppy.
We got a puppy. We got a quarantine puppy. We got a pandemic pup, and he is pretty great. He's like a horse wolf. He is 12 weeks old in a week. Okay, so he's 11 weeks old. That's how math works. And his paws are already the same size as our pit bull terrier's paws, who is an 80-pound pit. He's like a lamb. He's just all legs. And like sometimes he'll hop like all four. And he's clumsy as shit. And it's the first time I've had a purebred dog. We think he's a purebred anyway. As a Great Pyrenees, they're called. But they've got double dew claws. So this dog has 22 toes.
Wow.
So not only does he have giant fucking paws, but there's extra toes on the back too. So
if you got paws that big, you might as well throw a few extra toes on there.
You got the space. What are you going to do? It's like an open floor plan. Put a desk there. Sure. So that's been our last week has kind of been getting the puppy on the team, and he's doing all right. He's doing all right. He's pretty great. He's got a really good smell. He's a good smelling dog. You know, like dog head smell and like paw smell and like good smelling dog.
Very cool. Growing up, I knew some folks who had a Great Pyrenees, and they are the sweetest dogs from my sample size of one Great Pyrenees. Just a lovely, cuddly, giant animal.
Yeah.
I've got a clinically anxious daughter, and he was bought with the intent of getting emotional support training and doing all that kind of rigorous program stuff for her benefit. And like, basically the smallest girl is going to have the biggest dog. And I think it's really funny.
That's great. That's literally a Belle and Sebastian episode.
It is actually Belle and Sebastian, as I recall. Yeah.
I like my on brand thinking. I was like, you know, Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. That's what you got right there.
Yeah. Big lockjaw sized wolf. He looks like a wolf.
Yeah.
And it's great. That's my breaking news. Oh, I finished speaking of November wrapped. I finished the commentary edition for Elsa's thing. Is it at press? We talked about that last time I was on. But yeah, so November is all out and done in the world, and I've yet to receive comps, but I bought a copy from the store, so I know it exists. So I can at least physically see all four volumes together and feel like I've accomplished something.
Nice.
I can verify it does exist. I got my copy on the shelf. I am planning on clearing some time this weekend and just reading all four of them as a chunk.
Yeah.
Sweet.
I think I have three in my, you know, all three in the hardback version. I got the little signed cards in a couple too, thanks to Books with Pictures. But but I don't know if I have four already ordered, so I'm going to have to check. I keep ordering shopping at night. I'll just order $200 worth of comics on a list that just to email them and be like, can you order these? And and they do. And I forget. And then suddenly a package shows up with a bunch of comics. So I've got a nice stack.
There's worse problems to have.
Yep.
Well, so guys, we have some great comics.
We do. This is a strong month. This is a real strong month. You said before, well, we were rolling, but you said like 4 months back, they found it and like they started to hit it. And like, this just the books, like, it's what a great, and like they're making smart hires, which is the other thing. Like it's not just they can hire people now, and Stan isn't writing them all anymore, and like
Jack isn't drawing everything, and
yeah right, but like they have success, they can hire people,
yeah,
and it's growing, and it's all what a fun month.
And I've noticed, like, other than I think Mike Esposito, folks don't seem to be so worried if DC knows that they're working for them anymore, or they're not getting DC Moonlighters. They either come to Marvel or they're just not using the Moonlighters now. So, hey, remember that part at the top of the episode where I said this is May of 1968? That was a copy and pasting error. This is June of 1968.
We've lost a month. It's already.
Already, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Dude, we've lost 12 months. What are you talking about? Like,
That's true. Yeah. Although, and then I believe last time I was here was June 67, because last time I was on, we were talking Summer of Love. So
yes,
the Summer of Love is
right.
Over.
Mm-hmm.
And all right, now it's the Summer of Light.
It's a summer of shooting people is what it is. Cool. So
yeah, 68 bad year. Yeah. bad year
to be a public figure in America who's maybe trying to do decent things for people,
or a person of color.
Yes, I mean that's every year in America.
But this is a particularly tumultuous
hey, let's talk about some of those happy good times, because I think we've all had it too good for too long during COVID quarantine times. We really need to bum ourselves out a little bit, bring ourselves back down to earth.
Okay. I missed April. I missed the April episode, but when Martin Luther King was killed, there were riots all over the place, except in Boston. Every major city had a riot except Boston. James Brown was playing a show in Boston that night, and like single-handedly kept the crowd from destroying the town. There's a documentary on it. I think it's called The Night James Brown Saved Boston.
Wow.
I think it's on Peacock, or I saw it somewhere. I think I saw it just the other day. Like I ripped it off of a TiVo the first time it aired on VH1. And now it's like, it's been archived somewhere and viewable, but, yeah, check it out. It's super, it's an amazing show.
I've heard the story. I've never seen the footage, so I would love to check that out. Rob, why don't you kick us off with what was happening June 1968 in America and around the world?
Aye, aye, Captain. Okay, June 1st, 1968, Helen Keller, 87, American author, political activist, and lecturer, and the first deaf-blind person to earn a Bachelor of Arts qualification, died at her estate near Easton, Connecticut.
Now, she was not shot, just to be very clear.
And she was real.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard about this, but the TikTok kids, it is a thing on TikTok where people on TikTok are trying to convince kids that Helen Keller isn't real.
What?
Oh, man. What a world.
That's that's a very specific and random prank.
Yeah. And it's shitty. Like it's not good. It's not good enough.
The payoff doesn't justify the damage that it does to the world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's such a shitty... Anyway, fuck TikTok and fuck children. What's next?
I got something from the 3rd of June, 1968. Valerie Solanas shot and almost killed pop artist Andy Warhol after following him into his studio in New York City. Warhol survived the attack. He would recover following a 4.5-hour surgery. Solanas, a self-described radical feminist who had founded the Society for Cutting Up Men.
Scum.
Yep. Told police that she shot Warhol because, quote, he had too much control of my life. Warhol would spend 2 months recovering in a hospital, and Solanas would serve a 3-year sentence at the New York State Prison for Women.
Damn. Yep. Okay. Well, I guess it's going to get worse. So on the 5th of June... Moments after thanking supporters for his narrow victory over Eugene McCarthy in the California Democratic primary, Senator Robert F. Kennedy was shot and fatally wounded while walking through a corridor at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. After the 12:20 a.m. shooting, police arrested Sirhan Sirhan, a citizen of Jordan who had been a U.S. resident for 12 years. Kennedy was rushed to Central Receiving Hospital and then transferred to the Hospital of the Good Samaritan for surgery. He never regained consciousness and was pronounced dead more than 25 hours after he had been shot at the age of 42.
On the 8th of June, Robert Kennedy's funeral took place in Washington, D.C., 2 days after his death, after which he was buried in Arlington National Cemetery, adjacent to the grave of his brother, John F. Kennedy, the last surviving brother.
They killed Kennedy?
Oh, boy. You didn't listen to all the episodes. I'm sorry that you had to learn that.
I missed one. I've missed one.
Oh, yeah. That was not the one to miss.
God damn it.
And Teddy Kennedy, who was the last surviving brother from the family, he gave the eulogy at the funeral.
On the same day, James Earl Ray was arrested at Heathrow Airport in London for the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Scotland Yard officials said that he had been carrying a loaded pistol and two false Canadian passports bearing the name of Raymond Snade.
So at least we got that, I guess. James Earl Ray getting arrested. On the 19th of June, after two postponements, the Poor People's March on Washington took place in the nation's capital as a multiracial crowd of impoverished Americans gathered in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King Jr., who had organized the rally, was the keynote speaker at the rally.
Just 5 days later, at 11 a.m., this is the 24th of June, Washington, D.C. police enforced the U.S. Department of the Interior order to evict the 300 remaining members of the Poor People's Campaign from West Potomac Park. Despite concerns that the removal of the squatters, whose permit had expired the evening before, would become violent, the process was quietly completed in 90 minutes. A historian would note later that while the campaign secured a few concessions from federal agencies, it cannot be considered successful. President Johnson ignored it, and Congress closed its governmental coffers to the poor people's economic demands as the Vietnam War sapped the federal tax base.
Yep. On the 22nd of June, 1968, presidential hopefuls Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon won significant delegate victories in eight different states at the expense of rivals Eugene McCarthy and Nelson Rockefeller. Nixon notched nearly 75 more delegates spanning five states, while Humphrey comprehensively won his home state showdown with McCarthy in Minnesota. So buckle up, everybody. Here come Nixon.
I'm back.
On the 12th of June, the controversial film Rosemary's Baby, directed by Roman Polanski and starring Mia Farrow, premiered in the United States.
And speaking of film, on the 20th of June, director Robert Rodriguez, who resigned from the Directors Guild of America so that Frank Miller could be credited as his co-director on Sin City, was born in San Antonio, Texas. So that's what we got for this month for June 1968. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to start talking about some of the funny books that came out this month right here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Not counting romance, fashion, or Western comics or reprints, Marvel Comics published 17 titles this month, but five of them were not available to us on Marvel Unlimited.
How dare they?
It's getting worse. And now we can't get to Joe Keating's shelf to get all of the Sergeant Fury or, you know, the Captain Savage and his Leatherneck Raiders. So we didn't read that issue number five, Sergeant 50, number four. Our Sergeant Fury number 57, Sergeant Fury Annual number 4, featuring the Howlers at the Battle of the Bulge and the backup story Gary and Dick up front.
One more time.
Gary and Dick up front.
Thanks.
So we missed that. And one was Marvel Superheroes number 16. Which featured the debut of the Phantom Eagle, a World War I aviator. The character was created by writer Gary Friedrich and artist Herb Drimpy, who had only been with Marvel for about a year. And the fifth issue that wasn't on Marvel Unlimited was something we've mentioned a little bit at the top, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 4. It was a retelling of the very first Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. story by Leon Kirby, written by Roy Thomas and drawn by Frank Springer. And this is where I take us on a tangent. This is my panel of the month is, I call it extra credit because I, you know, bought this comic in addition to my Marvel Unlimited subscription. On page 3, panel 1 and only, Springer shows up really well to fill in on this issue, keeping the Steranko pop-op style. And other than a couple of weird renderings of Colonel Fury impressing me enough to go look him up. So Springer did a bunch of work for Dell in the early 60s and some Batman and House of Mystery work at DC right in 67 before hitting Marvel with his debut on this book. He did a little work on everything in his career, from adult comics to the Space Ghost cartoon animation scenes. Also, Brian, Springer did a fair run on G.I. Joe in the 80s.
You know, I was going to say I'm embarrassed to admit this. I'm not embarrassed to admit this. I think that is exactly the context that I know his name from.
Like, that's probably
I'm positive it's from 1980s G.I. Joe comics.
There's like a student film called Herb Crimpy, We Love You. It was made in like 1970 by college kids. And somebody found it. It's on YouTube. It's kind of been restored and put on YouTube again. It's a cool thing. If you want to check it out, it's kind of very sweet. Herb Crimpy fans making a little documentary about Herb Crimpy. And it's really cool. I love it. Like Steranko, Springer inked and colored himself. And I think it shows. I think it always shows. The Nick Fury number 4, like there's a SR-71 Blackbird that shows up in it, which I thought came around later. It was startling to see. It's like, was it that? And yeah, no, it like the first rolled out in like 1967. And again, it's the first issue told from the perspective of the Hydra guys. It's a really clever fill-in.
Yeah.
Also, if you can find the original, there's a letter from Don McGregor and a letter from a young Mr. Stephen Grant. In the letter column that month.
That's cool.
Already the tastemakers of tomorrow were letting their voices be heard in the pages of the most 1968 comic of all time. And that this comic came out with this cover the same month that the X-Men issue that we're going to talk about came out is nuts.
Yeah.
If those could have come out, those would be side by side. It is the weirdest. That feels like a comic that came out in 1958.
Yeah. It's like, it's the squares and the hipsters.
Literal beatnik battle. How can you? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But all of that still leaves us with 12 issues that we were able to read on Marvel Unlimited. We'll get into a couple of them in deeper detail later in the episode, but here are the quick hits. First, Captain America, number 105, In the Name of Batroc. Batroc, the swordsman, and the living laser team up to steal a seismo bomb in a heist that immediately goes sideways because they're idiots.
Yeah. And they almost wind up getting New York completely destroyed because they're so bad at stealing things.
It's good. It's a good Batroc book again, because
French.
He's very French. And there's nothing that can get him down. That guy is, he's fine.
Indefatigable?
Yeah.
That's the word. That is exactly it. But I didn't even want to try to get through the third syllable, so I gave up. But that's exactly it. He gets his butt kicked. He's impressed by things. He doesn't mind. He can take a hit and just be impressed by getting hit. That's Batroc. Yeah.
He participates joyfully in the suffering of the world. He lives the Buddhist ideal.
I want you to put it all into my face. I want you to rough punch me in the way your economic angst makes you feel. one of the best Kirby opening splashes was just an absolutely monstrous goon of a Nazi.
Yep.
Just like just almost an EC character, almost a Graham Engels Nazi opening up the issue, which is a lot of fun. And also too, I want to point out that this is two bombs in the same month New York had to deal, the seismo bomb and this, and then over the Avengers, and we're talking about a little H bomb. And also I think the different levels and layers, it's not even the right word, but like that you've got a hydrogen bomb. And Avengers, and Kirby's like, it's a seismo bomb.
It was a turbulent time.
It is a five-star Jack issue. It is an all-star. Yes. Also, yeah. He gets a Bucky doing the two-up, and it's
Yeah, and he's flipping. He's flipping off all British people.
It's not V for Victory. It's not V for Victory. It's deliberate. I guarantee you, that is such a deliberate.
So, Jack's been there.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like you can fill in some weird balloons on this panel, Stan. Also, in watching that news film, it reminds Cap that Bucky died. Like, because he just keeps forgetting that Bucky died, and then he remembers, and then he gets sad again. And that it actually leads him to decide that he can't have any sort of romantic relationship with Sharon Carter. So that's a new thread that's coming in there.
Why not? I've killed a child.
This is why I don't get a dog. I can't take the, I just can't take outliving anything. So this is all Cap's going through nonstop.
Speaking of Cap, over in Daredevil number 43, the story is called In Combat with Captain America, and I bet you can see where this is going. Daredevil.
Hey, is that a blind joke?
Oh.
Daredevil, he's pining over Karen Page's decision to quit Nelson and Murdoch because Matt won't commit to loving her because he's blind, and also he's Daredevil, but she doesn't know that. And so she's like, well, I got to move on. So she does.
And he's a real jerk to her just to like, cinch it just so that he can drive her away. So,
yeah. There's a pattern about how Stan handles some of these things.
Really?
Yeah. I've noticed that. Reed Richards, not a great husband.
That was the best reading when I was doing Fantastic Four, and I would read the Stan and Jack issues to my kids. We would point out like, wait a minute. That's jacked up. Hang on. We would stop and like pick apart why these were like, why does she just turn invisible? What's up with that? And like, they would, wait a minute. He's being a jerk to her. Like, it was really like the kids are all right. You know, like,
he's the goofest of husbands, in Marvel Comics. So Matt, to clear his head, he puts on the Daredevil duds, and he, recovers some stolen radium.
But not, he also declares himself a red hot swinging superhero.
Yes.
Yep.
That's what he loves. His tights and punching men.
We had the conversation about how Stan needs to stop using the word swinger and swinging, of all the things that have not aged well, that certainly hasn't.
Especially right after the Summer of Love. Like that is a known term at this point. Like it's a pretty big deal. So it's got to bubble up to Stan someday.
Eventually. We'll see. Anyway, so Daredevil recovers the stolen radium. It's very similar to the stuff that gave him his powers in the first place. Makes him go temporarily cuckoo. So he heads to Madison Square Garden, picks a fight with Captain America.
I love that byproduct of radiation. It's happened to Angel too. Just you get irradiated, you just get a little, you become pretty much a jerk for a while and then you're back to normal.
Some cause of and solution to all of our problems.
Yep. Over in Doctor Strange number 172, I Dormammu. Doctor Strange frees Clea from Dormammu's clutches, but Victoria Bentley remains trapped in the friend zone.
Yep. Still got that crush on Doctor Strange, who exposes her to tremendous danger so he can rescue the girl he actually is interested in.
Yeah, and then immediately ignores her.
Former student. Yeah, that is the thing that Doctor Strange fans don't care for when you write the character from the perspective of, oh, he's a teacher who sleeps with his students. There's certain moral choices that kind of man makes.
Did you get some tweets when you're writing Defenders, did you?
I got some sass. I got some pushback. some sass. Like it was we talked about this, I think, like the growing up in the library with the reprints, origins in the Doctor Strange book, like my first exposure to Doctor Strange was that first year of Strange Tales where he was basically William S. Burroughs. And that was my take, was like, I want a creep in a waistcoat. I want a creepy New York street magician. And like, oh yeah, no, he'd sleep with a student. That's what he did. That's his thing.
Yep.
Yep.
Doctor Strange fans, not so into you pointing that out, reminding them of that.
But she wanted it. He was in love with him. Oh, they learned. She got to.
Yeah. So the heart wants what the heart wants, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's weird. The Clea stuff is always weird. It's always fucking weird.
Yeah. There's a lot of weirness there.
Do you think the Stan Swinger thing is a little bit like the guy that is always bringing up strip clubs because he's never gone? Isn't that be crazy, right? If we were like, that'd be insane. That'd be nuts. You guys wouldn't want to do that, or that'd be nuts.
Yep. And then the 80s stand just like key party this and key party that. And it's
swing a ding ding. I have a great lifestyle as a chairman emeritus of Marvel Comics. It's a real swinging gig.
My face hurts already.
Yep. I don't know how to follow that up. I'm just going to go into Fantastic Four 78. No. Are you kidding? Fantastic Four 78, The Thing No More. It's the conclusion of a Galactus Silver Surfer story. So that means it's time for a self-contained single issue story in which Ben Grimm turns human. That's the way this works. This one, maybe not, as legendary, as This Man, This Monster, from FF51, but the Wizard does get a pair of new gloves. So that's something.
Wonder Gloves.
Wonder Gloves. It's like the first draft of the Nintendo Power Glove.
Over in Incredible Hulk number 107, 10 rings hath the Mandarin. Nick Fury deals with his Russian counterpart Yuri Brevlov as the Mandarin teleports the Hulk to China in a failed attempt to harness his strength for his own plans. That's something that happens with the Hulk quite a bit. He gets underestimated for his strength.
The best thing about this era of the Mandarin, aside from the incandescent racism, is that he's a Chinese man who I assume speaks Mandarin Chinese.
I hope so.
In China. Giant M right there on the chest for Mandarin. In case you don't speak Chinese and you don't know who I am.
Yeah.
He's a man of the world.
He's targeting the English speaking audience.
I love the Mandarin so much, you guys. And it's just so hard sometimes.
Yep.
But when you're a kid, it's like the 10 rings each. It's like 10 superpowers. Oh my God.
So like, this is a character you've written. How do you, how do you write the Mandarin?
Well, I worked with Kanye West, so I wrote him as Kanye West, and Kim Jong-il. I wrote him as a combination of those two. And there's a story about Kim Jong-il. He kidnapped a filmmaker and his wife from a film festival and took them into North Korea. And was like, listen, you're going to make my movie because I have the greatest film ever made. It's going to unify our people. It's going to bring peace to our peninsula, and it's going to mend. Like, I've got it. I have the film, but I'm not you. This is, you know, you're the finest filmmaker on either. Like, you could admit it. Like, listen, I'm sure I hit nothing but holes in one, and have never, you know, have whatever. All of those crazy. Of course, that's me. But I'm a filmmaker. I'm not you. I can't do your job. You're going to make my film for me. I'm going to tell you the story. You're going to make it. And we're going to not only unify Korea, we're going to bring about world peace. Filmmaker's like, well, you have guns on me and my wife, so I guess this is what we're doing. And the movie is called Pulgasari, and it's basically a Godzilla movie. And it is breathtakingly inept and amazing. And they make a fucking Godzilla movie and like sneak. And the director's wife sneaks out, gets away during... And then he eventually escaped as well. But it exists. Pulgasari exists, and you can find it and watch it. And it's just terminally stupid.
I want to waste that time.
Yeah. So I wrote, I had worked with Kanye West. So I sort of like put those two together, and it was like Mandarin kidnaps a filmmaker and his wife to make him a superhero, like make my superhero origin story of a movie. I'm going to rebrand myself. And it's that thing where, you know, those kind of people who lie all the time, it's clear that they don't even know the truth anymore. It's just there's 9 contradictions sometimes in the same sentence. And just that, like, you know, I didn't want to invalidate anything that had kind of come before and made it clear that this is just a guy who lies all the time. And we have no idea if he's telling the truth about it. Maybe he doesn't even know anymore. But it was a joy to write, like, to kind of rename what the rings were and refigure out what they were. It's like ice blast, fire blast, all that kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, it was just such a great, one of the great Marvel villains. And like, they've got a short bench of great villains, mm-hmm. and Mandarin's one of them. And yeah. like it was anything I could do to like recenter him a little bit. He was a character I wish I could write more of. You know what yeah. I mean? Like mm-hmm. he was fun.
It's a really good trick because I mean, like talking about characters that don't age well, a character who I mean he's Fu Manchu. I mean he's a oh, racial yeah. stereotype. Yeah. Yeah. And his name is a reference to that, and to be able to shed so much of that and still be able to tell a great story and reinvent it in a way that makes it compelling and leave all that garbage in the past. It's a really good trick. I'm very impressed that you pulled it off.
And just to like explicitly acknowledge that, yeah, it was propaganda.
Yeah.
We, you know, it was a war of propaganda, and you know, I'm still here, right? Like,
yeah,
like him and Doom. I never managed to get those two in a room together, but that was like that would have been a trip. That would have been a lot of fun. But he's one of my favorite Marvel all-time villains. This is a great example of why, and also a great example of why those early stories can be so toxic and so long, you know, so gross. But like, you know, Stan worked. And like he and like the propaganda, like he.
Oh yeah.
I think we may have joked about this last time. Like I've always wondered if he was on that, like if he was getting money from the government for how virulently anti-communist these books are.
Yeah.
Because he's doing it for free, otherwise, right? It's like it's paying work, and you're doing it for free. I don't know. But this is a perfect example of that, just virulently racist propaganda laden. Yeah. But like the character is so cool, it survives it.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. The Yellow Claw did not.
exactly. Yes. No one gives a shit about Fu Manchu and Yellow Claw.
Yeah.
Mandarin, though. Mandarin's got a good year coming up.
Well, talking about Mandarin, great Iron Man villain, and this month in Iron Man number 5, Frenzy in a Far-Flung Future. It's a really solid Archie Goodwin story. I'm so glad that we have gotten to Archie Goodwin being a Marvel writer now.
Ooh, yeah.
He's one of my... Yeah. all-time favorites.
One of the dudes I didn't meet, and him and Mark Gruenwald, and like they both passed before I was kind of in the industry at all.
Yep.
And when you go to shows and you're that age, those guys are never the superstar dudes that are on the top of your list when you're 13 or whatever. But like I've always wish I got to know Denny O'Neill a little bit, and that was pretty great. Like I got to talk to Denny, and he was a great dude. And like this is just like my heart hurts. I never got a chance to buy this guy a cup of coffee, but
yeah.
I love his work.
I got to hand Denny O'Neill a copy of the only comic book that I've ever had published when I was a teenager, and it was rad as hell. A friend of mine had taken a comic book writing class from him, and so I had an in there, and I got to talk to Denny for like 10 minutes.
Did you like give it to him?
I left him with a copy of it, and you know, I think he was enough of a gentleman that he left it in his bag until he got back to the hotel. That was, yeah, he was very nice. And talking about Mark Gruenwald, this is a conversation I think we had off the air with Elliot Kalin when he was a guest, but we had both independently of each other had just read during quarantine times, like Gruenwald's 100 issue run on Captain America, which is just like, I remember reading that, you know, when it was coming out. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
this is how you write Captain America. It's like this is how this character works.
And
then he turns into a wolf. It's great.
And you're with it. And I'm with it. I'm going with it.
I'm on this ride. Yeah.
Yeah.
It, that's a, so cool, it man.
Creates a female MODOK called MODAM.
Gruenwald wrote and drew the Hawkeye miniseries that made me love Hawkeye.
He drew that?
He drew it. That's how much Mark Gruenwald loved Hawkeye. He drew the Hawkeye miniseries that he wrote. I've been told that he was the spirit of Marvel, that he was the kid who grew up reading Stan's soapbox and showed up ready to work in the bullpen. And it was a bunch of guys from Queens doing jobs. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who made it fun. Like he started pulling pranks and doing funny shit and like
made it the bullpen. Yeah.
Mark was the guy who made it a fun place to work. They still feel his loss there. You know what I mean? Like he's still spoken of reverently. And I'm sure the way Archie is spoken of at DC.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No one has a bad word to say about Archie Goodwin. And this is a really good story. Tony Stark, he gets basically kidnapped and sent to the far future, where he faces a reckoning for creating Cerebrus, the supercomputer that went on to conquer Earth. I cannot stress this enough. It was not Cerebus. That's a very different thing.
Or Cerberus. It is Cerebrus. It is given bigger font size than the rest of the words in the balloon.
Yeah, all of those things are problematic in their own rights, but this specifically was a supercomputer that took over the future.
Yeah, it was. I love the AI kills the world stories, yeah. And so much that I'm working on my own stuff like that for music. But it's like, this was a beautiful, it's like, you know, Matrix 3 or something, you know, it's just getting into some pretty crazy ideas of a dystopian future controlled by a supercomputer that he made. So that there was some nice twists there.
And this and the Avengers issue, not to spoil it, but the kind of Ultron stuff, like it's there's a group think they haven't found the thing yet, but it's close. And you can see where someone's like, this is kind of a test drive of Ultron, you know?
Yeah. Well, in Submariner number 5, watch out for Tiger Shark. Namor gets another addition to his rogues gallery as Dr. Dorcas transforms injured Olympic swimmer Todd Arliss into Tiger Shark. There's so many fun things in this issue. My favorite is the first time Dr. Dorcas, when I read the name Dr. Dorcas and Brian sent me a text saying what'd you say, Brian?
He didn't go to 6 years of dork school for you to call him Mr. Dork.
But he's like in his green jumpsuit in his underwater lab and he's talking to somebody and he's just like, hey, Todd, what do you think of this? And Todd looks like he's just a henchman that he just gets called Todd. No henchman gets called their first name. So I was like, what is the deal with Todd? Like instantly just riveted because he just mentioned Todd by his first name in such a weird way. Turns out it's Todd Arliss, famous, you know, Olympic swimmer.
The Todd Arliss.
And he gets transformed pretty horrifically into Tiger Shark.
Gills on his cheek, his teeth all get sharp.
Yep, he can't breathe air. I thought he was going to at least be an amphibian because he's got like some sort of Namor powers and shark powers. But
Dr. Dorcas is fucking Todd all up.
Yep, he's just like, yep, you get the power, but you have to stay in the water, Tiger Shark. So, sorry, Todd.
Yeah, I don't even know why he wanted to do that to him. I don't know why any of these guys want to do any of this stuff, honestly.
They had bad childhoods, I'm pretty sure.
So.
This is one of 3 issues that Roy Thomas wrote this month, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I want to swing back to. This is the thing I'm excited to talk about in Avengers, but this was one of Roy's 3 this week. And another John Buscema just dashes this off. Terrific. It's solid, awesome. Amazing.
Yeah.
Namor was a blast to write. Namor was always fun to write. I loved writing Namor. He was one of the I got him right away. Like I knew who, like I wrote a bit where I guess basically he's given up on ever sleeping with Susan Richards. So he moves to the next blonde, which was Emma Frost. Wrote a thing where Emma has kind of is trying to lure him and is wearing very little and trying to as she does kind of overwhelm with her sexuality. And she gets into the back of this limousine and he's like stretched out wearing like the Flash Gordon or like the Sting bikini from Dune. Mm-hmm. And like, that's it. And just like lounged out, like even more sinewy and revealing than she is. And it's like, if I look like Namor, I would never wear anything.
Yeah.
But that, like, just once I had the guy who would wear like bikini bottoms in a limo to pick a woman up for a date.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, just so you see what's on the menu. I got him right away.
No cards hidden here. Yeah.
This is just literally nothing on my sleeve. And I love, he gets put in a weird gimp vest, the weird
electric shock gimp vest.
He wears his his punish suit. Yeah, it's a great issue. Such fondness for this book.
Yeah, there's also a lot. Roy is starting to get past this, but there's a lot of the thinking in this huge, you know, monologue as you're fighting something, and then just blurting out things that turn to speech bubbles in the middle of a thought. And like, I love it when it happens with Captain America. Stan does it all the time too, but it's just like Cap doing all this thinking, and then he suddenly says like, it's hula time. And you know, and so and somebody from Hydra is like, what in the hell? Why would you just yell it's hula time after this whole right. fight? You know,
think, shout. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like shouting. He starts shouting. Namor does in this on a butt. You know, so he's in the middle of thoughts, and then he's like, but though the struggle, and the tiger shark's got to be like, what are you talking about?
God, I said the inside thing on the outside.
Yeah. Let's see. One more quick hit. Thor 155. The story is called Now Ends the Universe. That is false advertising. The universe does not actually end in this issue. But we do get to see Mangog shred every Asgardian warrior who stands in his way before he faces off with Thor at the very end of the issue. Mangog is great.
Mangog.
He's just a monster. Like when Kirby gets to do a great Kirby monster, the plot on this one is so thin. It's just Mangog tearing shit up and he just like bodies in his wake and Thor just following this trail of them like breadcrumbs.
Oh yeah. They're putting him over so much. I mean, it's great. It's like, he is terrifying. And every Asgardian warrior Thor comes across is like, yeah, we would throw down it for you for anything, but we just got, you know, our asses handed to us by Mangog. So we're going to go cry, you know, good luck.
Yeah.
And it's every time he just keeps passing people. Yeah.
So much fun.
Awesome. There's a really good Thor Loki scene too. Loki has taken the throne of Asgard and Thor shows up in Asgard and Loki's like, you're not getting this throne. He's like, there's a Mangog coming. Like, get your sense of perspective. Like it's great. And then after that, Loki's just sort of like, oh wait, like, anything we should be doing, and there was just like, I will handle this. It's wonderful.
Ego, the Living Planet, pops up in a panel because that's how Kirby rolls. Mm-hmm. It's such a good issue, not even Vince Coletta could ruin it. And Vince Coletta tries several times.
Yeah. There would have been twice as many bodies lying on that battlefield if anyone else had inked
That's it. True. I those big, you know, group scenes, he's just gonna knock out half of those people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, so there's our quick hits. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the debut of a new Marvel writer right here on Marvel by the Month.
Is it me? Oh, no. It's me.
Okay, welcome back. We're going to talk about the debut of Arnold Drake as a writer in the Marvel bullpen. Marvel has been expanding their line over the past year or so. There's definitely a need for more writers and artists. I think you're also starting to see a pecking order developing in the writing hierarchy. You got, of course, Stan is at the top. He's writing Spider-Man. He's writing Fantastic Four, Captain America, Daredevil, Thor. You know, and his name's on everything. He's, you know, the editor. Yeah, Roy Thomas right there as the number two. He's got the most seniority of the writers at this point. He's doing Avengers and Doctor Strange and Submariner. I think the biggest indication that Roy has come up in the ranks is that he's able to get himself off of the books that he doesn't want to be writing. So he's not writing X-Men anymore. He's not writing Captain Marvel. He's like, you just like Stan did to him, he is now doing to other writers is like, now just take this over, please. Archie Goodwin's in there. I would put him like right in the middle of the pack at this point. He's only writing one book, but it's a really important book. Like Iron Man is a core Marvel title. He had been the head writer and the editor in chief for the Warren magazines prior to coming to Marvel.
And he was still, I think, on and off. I don't know that. Like, I believe those books ran in tandem, and, you know, and he was also a cartoonist, so Archie was doing his own. If you have a chance to seek out a Big Apple comics published by Flo Steinberg, It is like the New York answer to Zap and Weirdo. It is a New York cartoonist doing an underground comic.
Oh, right.
Archie does a guide to the best peep show booths in Manhattan. It's the weirdest, sweet, most un-Archie thing in the world. I got Flo, when I met Flo, I got her to sign it, and she looked at it and she went, "Oh my God, it's so dirty." And I was like, "It's okay." I asked my mom when I got confused. She helped me understand. And she's like, "I hope you didn't pay a lot of money for it. I have boxes of these in my living room." Fabulous Flo, man.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Gary Friedrich is kind of like your junior. He's like your ringer. Gary Friedrich is here, and he's kind of like picking up. He's your mid-inning grinder. He's just kind of.
Yeah. He's your utility guy. Yeah. They're putting him on the stuff that's either not big sellers or not particularly choice assignments. He's on Incredible Hulk right now. He's on Sergeant Fury, which I think sold pretty well, but was not considered a super choice assignment. He's on X-Men now, which just keeps getting passed around because no one knows what to do with this book.
And he did, but then like over in Marvel Superheroes, like he you know, he's doing more war stuff, and yes, you know, like, yeah, like it's he's clearly got a métier. He's hanging in there, and then yeah, now they make their first big hire.
Yeah. So Arnold Drake comes in this month on Captain Marvel #5. Captain Savage in his Leatherneck Raiders #5, and he's co-writing X-Men 47 with Gary Friedrich. So Drake had been around for a while. He came over from DC. The first comics thing he had ever done was what we would now, I guess, call a graphic novel. It rhymes with lust.
It rhymes with lust.
So it's like, you know, film noir, femme fatale, crime story. And Matt Baker illustrated it, who is like a legendary
good girl art.
The good girl art.
And he was an artist of color.
Yes.
And really did astonishing, gorgeous stuff. But yeah, one of the earliest kind of most prominent black men in the industry.
Yeah.
In the white part of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But so they've done some reprints of It Rhymes with Lust over the years. I've got it around here somewhere, but it's fun if you ever find it. It's a little bit like His Name is Savage, or like it's not quite there yet, but like you can see the thinking that's going to lead to graphic novels.
Yes. I think it's like I described, it's historically important. It's not necessarily a great work, but it is the thing that needs to get done in order to get both the creators and the medium, you know, to where it winds up.
If you're an Arnold Drake fan, it's his soft parade, you know, like it's the one for the fans, you know what I mean? Like you really gotta be,
into it.
But like it's a fun curiosity for sure. Yep. But like, yeah, check it out. It's been reprinted. You don't have to pay too much for it.
No. And he did it in 1950. It was like literally, if not the first thing he did, it was one of the very first things he did. But he started writing for DC Comics in the mid-50s. And I think notably, he was one of the only guys at DC who was paying attention to what Marvel was doing as early as like 1962. Like as soon as Marvel started doing superheroes, he was seeing how this is going. And so he and Bob Haney, was another DC guy, they came to DC's publisher, Irwin Donenfeld, with like copies of the Marvel books and saying, it's like, this is the future. We have to start doing stuff like this. And Donenfeld basically blew them off. He said, we do 100 million a year and they do 35 billion. And like, that was it. He was just hearing nothing about it. And then not long after that, Murray Boltonoff, who was a DC editor, gave Drake an opportunity to develop a new feature in a book called My Greatest Adventure. Drake created the Doom Patrol in 4 days.
Sweet.
And and there was always like some speculation that the concept of X-Men, which came out like literally just 2 months later, was ripped off.
X-Men is Marvel's Doom Patrol.
Yeah. It's
ironic that Arnold Drake has now come to X-Men.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
It's very, very much that first. They're doing Weird Freaks. We're going to do Weird Freaks.
Yeah,
that was Marvel. It was Marvel's Weird Freak book, and they were kids, which the Doom Patrol were with Garth and Rita skewed younger than the Justice League. Robot Man and Larry Traynor were a little age ambiguous, but like it was definitely there was a younger, weirder book for sure.
Yeah. And they both had leaders who were wheelchair bound. The Doom Patrol fought the Brotherhood of Evil. The X-Men fought the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
Right.
A lot of crossover there. It is kind of cheeky though for Drake to have thought that it's like, oh, X-Men just ripped me off, because like the Doom Patrol is obviously very clearly his take on Fantastic Four too. You know, like, I mean, they've got like Negative Man is the Human Torch and Robot Man is the Thing and the Chief is Reed Richards, you know, like he's trying to do a Marvel book at DC. And it ran for a while. It had like a 3 or 4 year run. And as soon as it was over, Drake bolted for Marvel. Supposedly it all had to do with a dispute with Erwin Donenfeld over DC's page rate. Drake thought he should be getting paid more. But Mark Evanier says that Drake, among others, was ousted for being a loud voice in a writer's revolt, during which several of the firm's longtime freelancers were demanding health insurance, reprint fees, and better pay. So
yeah, they fired all the old men. And Neil Adams was like, oh, guys, you should unionize. I'll stand with you. Neil Adams. They fired everybody but Neil Adams. And and fucking Bob Kaniger. They kept his fucking Kazan, the comic book. But also, like Doom Patrol ended, and he was right at Marvel. Like I think they didn't give him work.
No, I don't think so. Yeah,
I think he was. I don't know what month Doom Patrol ended actually, but like
I think the last issue of Doom Patrol comes out like 1 month after this month's Marvel Comics. So
yeah, I was gonna say it sure feels like it was probably. Oh no, you don't want me to do Jerry Lewis again this month. All right, goodbye.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about what he wrote for Marvel here. Let's talk about Captain Marvel number 5, The Mark of the Metazoid.
Immediately, it literally references Homer in his first sentence.
Yes. He goes, yeah.
Like right away, this is not Stan and it's not Roy.
Yeah.
Like right away, there is a different sensibility. And like he was this kind of like, he kind of was like a beatnik guy. He was like into this consciousness stuff, you know. He had interest in other cultures and faiths and spiritualities and practices, and kind of it informs all of his work. He was a very much a 60s writer, you know. Mm-hmm. My line has always been that like DC comics are for narcs. They're by narcs for narcs. Right, there's so it's weird. It doesn't play like this in Captain Marvel, but it does in X-Men. His X-Men issue is very much like, I think a narc wrote this.
Yeah.
but there, this whole issue is, it's just so, like, right away, right? There's like I said, like Wine Dark Sea. All right, new writer, new guy is here. And
yep.
Like, the story declares on its title page, we're reading an interstellar saga of the fifth magnitude. I don't know what the fuck that means. Yeah. And I love it. And I'm so psyched. I'm so over them fourth magnitude sagas. I could not tell you like right away what a brilliant piece of bullshit that is. What a perfectly Stanian bit of fuck the Marvel Age. This is the fifth magnitude.
Yep. Just hyping it and waxing philosophical. And, you know, the characters are already doing things. I had to go back and check this because I didn't really see Arnold Drake when I started reading it. So I'm like, this is obviously somebody different, which is not always a thing that happens when you're reading these early comics. That's like with the writing, you know, it's like Stan's been guiding it, but this is different. And so this is art by Don Heck, John Tartaglione. The issue starts with Mar-Vell narrowly convincing Ronan the Accuser not to find him guilty of siding with the human race over the Kree. Then a U.S. submarine encounters our antagonist for this issue, the Metazoid. He's a Soviet citizen.
Reminds us 3 or 4 times in his monologue that he is, in fact, the Megazoid. Like it's like he thinks of himself in the third person. It's pretty great.
Yeah,
he shouts about being the Metazoid a number of
Metazoid,
times.
Not Megazoid, I apologize. Yeah. Right.
He should have said it more often.
The Metazoid
stand against Yeah.
Right, so he's a Zoid about Zoids. He's
yeah,
the Zoid
exactly.
About.
Yeah.
Right. Now you're regular Zoids. No, no, no. Yeah. I'm the Metazoid. I'm the Zoid that refers to the other Zoids.
Yeah. He's not a large Zoid.
So then he what he is a Soviet citizen convicted of anti-state activities who was experimented on and transformed into a pretty monstrous beast who's also very, very emo sad.
And like, so right away, like the story begins with Mar-Vell trying to convince the Kree. It's like, no, I'm totally a loyal and faithful citizen. And then we cut to the antagonist. He's exactly in the same situation. It's just, he wasn't as good at talking his way out of the situation. So, yeah. So he gets turned into a monster.
And he turned into an assassin monster, not yeah. just a monster, yeah. but like, now you're going to go out and kill people. And he does. And like, yeah. there's this kind of weird nihilistic existential killing an Arab, like just, what kind of horrible beast does what I, the Metazoid yeah. does. Yeah, I'm going to fuck this guy up. It's an auspicious beginning for him. And I know he doesn't stay at Marvel terribly long,
no.
but like it's right away. He paves the way for Starlin to come into Captain Marvel, like the start of cosmic consciousness, which might even fucking be an Arnold. Like I would have to reread these. It's been like 15 years since I've read these, but like that whole era, I super love. Cause it's that liminal space between a kind of throwaway comic that didn't work and this, you know, where it kind of went, the cosmic, yeah, all that stuff is here. And the whole kind of MacGuffin, for lack of a word, the whole plot driver is he's got to go erase a guy's memory, and that plays into the angst of it all.
Yeah, and the way he describes it's basically the humane alternative to killing him, which is what Ronan originally wants him to do,
right?
But he's like, you know, it's painless, it's not really going to leave any lasting effects. It's like, he'll know that something's missing, and it'll make it a little
him
nuts.
Forever.
Like, I mean, that's yeah. basically, it's just like, it'll trouble him forever. Yeah. And it's just, he does think about it for a second and he mentions it and he moves past it.
Yeah. No one in the story is doing, other than like Yon Rogg, is doing anything they want because of yeah. the authoritarian regimes they belong to.
Yeah.
The end of this story is just Mar-Vell, as Walter Lawson, his civilian identity, goes to the hospital, tries to erase the memory of his hotel manager, Jeremy Logan. We get to know his whole name. And that's, he just fights Metazoid, and eventually does wipe the guy's memory and gets out just before he's discovered. So, otherwise he'd be wiping more memories, or Ronan would be like, just kill the hospital, you know?
Oh, and he kills the Metazoid with like an X-ray blast.
And that's creepy. And then, the Metazoid is sort of reduced to this kind of weird stone husk, but like it's clearly also the Metazoid's corpse.
Yeah.
Like, he's dead. He's definitely dead. I know what that looks like in comics. It looks like that.
Yep. And he's mentioning lifeless eyes and things as he's gazing on this. So yeah, it's everything but saying, I murdered this guy.
Yeah, it's a crazy issue. And there's a weird moment of the we get the little slice of life of the magazine where Carol Danvers is already, while based on Gloria Steinem, has already taken on her mantle of vibe harsher emeritus of the Marvel U, and they have a completely disgusting, well, it's not as disgusting. They have a sexist, an exchange with a lot of sexist differential between the men and Carol, mm-hmm. and Carol calling them on it. And then, but like it's the men kind of a writer, and that's the thing. It's like, oh, you don't like it when men try to run roughshod over you. Yeah, I get it. You're one of those modern girls or whatever.
Yep.
And then, so the scene is the scene or whatever. But then the next page is he's in a cab, and there's a guy like wearing a fedora with this kind of smile on his face, and like it was almost like the discussion was had for him. Like I wish, like, m'lady. Like it was just a total caricature of an internet guy.
Oh man. Okay.
Yep.
Well, let's jump over to X-Men number 47. So this is again, this is different thing altogether. The Warlock wears three faces. Written by Gary Friedrich and Arnold Drake, art by Werner Roth with John Tartaglione. As of last issue, the X-Men are tired of no one reading their comic, so they've split up and scattered across the country to see if that improves sales. That seems like it should be the actual plot. Beast and Iceman encounter Maha Yogi, a.k.a. the Warlock, a.k.a. fake Merlin, who's up to his old hypnotizing tricks. So he's, you
those
know,
are the three faces.
There you go.
This whole like Maha Yogi thing has to be a reaction to like what all the Beatles were.
Yeah, the Maharishi.
It's all Drake. It's all Drake. That's the sort of quasi, like the kind of the weird village shyster, exploitative, clearly white dude, coded as a white dude, dressed as a cartoon swami. Like everything about him says ripoff. And like for an issue that sees a bunch of beatniks rough up a couple of young men wearing suits, it's surprisingly trenchantly observant of youth culture at that moment, you know.
Yeah, and this all takes place in the village, right?
Yeah. All of it takes place in like the nightclub
near the Coffee A Go-Go.
Of course.
And the Beatles went to India in February of 1968. A thing that people are thinking about.
And there's already been debate, you know, as the Beatles come back from Ringo and John and starting to question, while Paul's like, Paul, he just rolls with it. But Sexy George City, is way into it. Yeah. So, So he's trying to assemble a psychic army, just basically hypnotizing everybody, but sort of planting the Manchurian candidate bomb in their minds so he can control them later. But because Beast and Iceman have trained with the late Professor X, they have some resistance to his tricks. They don't say what that is, but they
recognize him right away. They right away know who he is and what he's up to. They right away, they're like, oh, it's a Warlock. We should go fuck him up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Don't let our dates know. Our dates have to think we're cucks.
Yep. So they duck out. They knock the power out and duck out. Change.
Yes, they have an entire fight scene in the dark.
Yep.
Get away from their girlfriends, who they.
And so this is after they fought some beatniks in the Coffee A Go-Go, more subtly. So now it's just they basically beat this Warlock by a bunch of noise. So Iceman makes an ice hand to grab a hi-fi. This is like Green Lantern stuff. To grab a hi-fi that's screeching at top volume, pushes it towards him. He hates it. It's a fake Merlin's weakness is noises. So
I was certain that there was going to be reference to like modal jazz or something. It's not. It's just allowed. I just the impression is it's just feedback. But I was amazed they didn't like it. It's an issue full of shots at hipsters. They didn't make a music one, I actually stopped to go back and reread. Like, did I miss something? Because like, why did they not say that this was that awful jazz? Like, what is?
Yeah.
And I it's also just funny that this guy's. I mean, all I kept thinking about was like autism, like his weakness is just this really annoying thing. And then he breaks down. He literally cannot take it. It's something that everyone else can handle in the room.
Yeah.
He's too old. It's too loud. He's, and 2/5 of the X-Men win their first fight since Professor X appeared to die. So
successfully beating up an old man in the dark.
Yep. Yep. There's a backup story with Iceman showing how his ice powers work and really
becoming kind of the Iceman that we would learn as a generation to love as one of Spider-Man's amazing friends. Like the kind of power set has grown in that backup, especially where it's like, oh yeah, that's totally Spider-Man in the hand. You know, it's totally Spider-Man and Amazing Friends quality Iceman now.
Yeah. A little more cartoony. Yep. And, this is getting into some cool waters. Yeah.
And look, and you are 9 issues away from Neil Adams showing up.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you've got the hippest, weirdest book in the world for a couple issues. It's a glorious Viking funeral of a year ahead of you.
Yeah, it's kind of like the almost like the beginning of this whole Silver Age for Marvel. You know, like they're like, try the Fantastic Four, take a swing at it. If it doesn't make it, who cares? We're not making any money anyway. And that's what X-Men is right now. Like, yeah. They're like, we can make money with this, but just put anybody who comes in on this book and see if they survive and see if it survives.
Yep.
And see if they can write. See if they can do it.
Exactly. And if they can't, I mean, no shame. And if they can, we'll put them on something better. And then we'll just hand the book off to the next sucker. So, I want to read more stories about old guys beating up young guys. Should we take a break and then check in on Spider-Man?
Oh, yeah. That's his jam. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month.
All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We're going to talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 64, The Vulture's Prey, written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita and Don Heck, with Mickey DeMeo, that is Mike Esposito, on the inks. So this is the conclusion of a two-part story that began last issue. Spider-Man took a bad tumble in the rain, messed up his arm last issue.
Beaten up by a puddle.
Most injured superhero in the Marvel Universe. We also learned that the original Vulture, Adrian Toomes, didn't actually die in prison after all, like we thought he did. He stole back the pair of Vulture wings that Blackie Drago used in his outing as the Vulture. And then he busts Drago out of jail so he can beat him up and prove that he's the real deal, which is pretty great. I like a villain.
It's a little Gran Torino. This is kind of Vulture's Gran Torino.
It really is. And then during their fight, the wounded Spidey rescues a kid from a hilariously precarious balcony before he can tears in heaven over the side of it.
You know that Eric Clapton invented dubstep?
What?
Tears in Heaven was the first it dropped.
That is terrible. And I'm leaving it in.
I deserve it.
Spidey saves the kid on the balcony, but by doing so, he draws the attention of old Vulture, who's just finished beating up Blackie Drago and is ready for more. So first of all, before we start talking about this issue, I just want to take a moment to appreciate just how absolutely crazy Spider-Man drives all of his enemies. Like, they hate him so much, like with a burning passion. He can say three words to them and they just want to murder him. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. That's why they call him the Amazing Spider-Man.
That's it. Yeah. That's probably his actual superpowers. He just makes people so mad that they can't think straight and they just make a bunch of dumb decisions.
That would be cool if there's an actual like a pheromone effect. Like there's an actual like, no, he just bugs the shit out of you. It's part of his power. He makes you so like cranky.
Yeah. It's why he wasn't on a team for 40 years, you know?
Yeah. Nobody can stand him.
Yeah.
The spider smell. You smell like spiders. It's something no one has ever said.
So on the surface, like the surface level, this is a really straightforward story. Cause last issue was a lot of setup and this is the payoff,
like two panel pages, just a massive, excellent fight comic, like one of the all time Spidey fight comics. And if you forget that he hurt his arm falling in a puddle,
he might remind you.
He's got this busted wing the whole time. And there's a genuine, he's not fight. Like it's a genuinely, like it works. He's like, oh no, he's hurt. Like it's like when a wrestler isn't in, like, you know what I mean? Like he's just like, oh man, he's at a genuine disadvantage. And it's played into strategically in the way Vulture fights.
Yes.
And even Spidey miscalculates at one point. He does that cool upside down flippy thing. And he's like, oh no, I can't hold on with my arm. Ah! Yep. Like, what a great fight. What a great fucking fight.
So good.
I love watching 20-year-old mercilessly beat 78-year-old men.
And I mean, Spidey's playing defense the entire time. It's great. He's having trouble landing solid blows because the Vulture is either, he's either in the air, so he can't really connect, or, you know, his injuries keeping him from being able to use his strength.
And irony of ironies, he's trying to protect JJJ and Robbie on the roof the whole time because the fight is happening like across the street from the Daily Bugle. And like, Yeah. So in the middle of it all, not only is it like he's constantly trying to protect the guy who hates him more than anyone.
Yes. And that's like, so about halfway through the battle, Vulture sends Spidey crashing into J. Jonah Jameson and Joe Robertson. That's not enough. That should have been the warning sign. It's like, okay, this is getting a little intense. We should go back inside. They don't. So they're still there when the Vulture swoops in to get Spidey again. He misses Spidey. He sends a chunk of masonry falling toward them. So Robbie pushes Jonah out of the way, and he winds up taking the brunt of it. And this leads to my panel of the month, which is on page 11, panel number 2. This is right after Robbie's been hit with the masonry, and Jonah is so enraged that he grabs Spider-Man from behind and he holds him so the Vulture, he tries to hold him so that Vulture can hit him. He can't hang on to him, of course, but it's just such a brilliant way to show just how crazy Spidey makes Jonah. Like, again, coming back to...
Smells like spiders.
Yeah, smells like spiders. And just the fact that he's not doing this for circulation. He's not doing this, you know, for attention. He's doing
this because I hate you.
I just hate you so much. Yeah.
He believes his own lies. Yeah.
Then we have an interlude in the middle of this crazy fight. Mary Jane got a haircut.
Ta-da.
And she looks now like, Angela Schuyler from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Ruby, the lady that seduces Hillary Bray, who's allergic to chicken.
Right.
That hair, like she has the little button nose and everything. Like it's like, oh, that totally is what Ruby looks like in Honor Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out the reference. Like, cause I was like, okay, obviously this is meant to, like there's someone who's hot right now who they're trying to make her look like, and I couldn't put it together.
Yeah. It's also a disastrous haircut.
It's not good. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes you got to make those mistakes. But then we have another interlude. George Stacy remembers that Peter didn't beat him up when he was brainwashed. He was trying to help me, which makes it sound like maybe he is still brainwashed.
Spider-Man only hits me when I make him angry.
It's my fault.
But anyway, Gwen is very relieved because, you know, she's been pining over Peter. So they just happen to find their way to the Daily Bugle just in time for the big showdown.
They also casually drop that Harry has had a nervous breakdown just in their father-daughter chit chat. You know, how far away are we from the LSD issue?
That's 70, 71, 71, 72.
Okay. So it's coming.
Yeah. It's coming. Yeah. So our big showdown, Spidey desperately grabs the legs of the Vulture, who kicks him off and sends him plummeting to the street. But Spidey whips up a web cushion to soften his landing. And when the Vulture flies down to inspect what he is certain is going to wind up being Spidey's corpse, Spidey grabs the power pack on his back and rips it out. So there you go. That's how Spidey wins, because the Vulture's wings are quickly losing power. So he flaps away. But then Spidey basically passes out on the street in the middle of a crowd who is determined to unmask him. And there you go. There's your cliffhanger to be continued.
Did you watch the Justice League Unlimited show? Do you remember the one where Lex Luthor and Flash switched bodies? Like Lex Luthor is supposed to, like his brain is supposed to go into Superman, but it ends up going into the Flash. And at one point he's like, well, at least I can finally learn the secret identity of the Flash. He takes his mask off and he's staring at himself in the mirror. He goes, I have no idea who this is.
Yes.
All I could think of, let's unmask him. Who is he? He's a dude. I don't know.
Check his ID, man. Yeah.
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 But you know that Gwen and her dad are in the crowd. So if that mask comes off, they're going to know.
Yeah.
Let's take a break and then come back and Rob will lead us through the Avengers, the conclusion to the cliffhanger from last month. So,
don't
go anywhere.
Hour 6 of June 1968.
This is going to be a month long by the time we're done with it. All right. We'll be right back on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Avengers number 55, Mayhem Over Manhattan.
My favorite Muppets movie.
Gonzo finally gets the chicken. This is written by Roy Thomas, art by John Buscema with George Klein. This is another conclusion to a two-part story that began last week, and it's a big one. So Roy Thomas is really starting to catch fire on his Avengers stories. The Masters of Evil broke into Avengers Mansion and took Hawkeye, Black Panther, Wasp, and Goliath prisoner. And as a reminder, the new Masters of Evil lineup is the Melter, Whirlwind.
tell me that's not a little sucking up to the boss. The Masters of Evil. What does Stan like? He really likes melting. We've talked about this. He likes blue characters and melty characters. I'm true. Not, I can't. Roy, you're sucking up. You know this is the boss's favorite.
No reason for the Melter to be there. Iron Man's not there. No one on this team has any sort of iron, you know, armor or anything like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's just there to melt human flesh, which he does have that setting.
He does
mention it too. Yeah.
Also argue, really, that would melt anything pretty much.
Just do the high level melting, unless you're trying to save on your melting power.
Very
you know.
Explicitly yeah. a human flesh setting on his melter. Some of us would just call this fire. You can call it a melt human flesh setting, whatever you need.
He's just really obsessed with melting. He likes to.
He really is.
I would be surprised if he put like a cheese on there. Just a real low grade cheese melter would be nice.
Something smells delicious, Hawkeye. I think it's you.
So we get Melter. We get the former human top, Whirlwind. Claw, which is pretty big power. Radioactive Man, which is terrifying. And the Crimson Cowl. The Crimson Cowl, as we learned last issue, is either a robot who has not yet introduced itself as Ultron, or Jarvis, the Avengers butler who sold them out. We're not sure exactly. They're both wearing the cowls. You know, it could be anybody.
I just don't know who it's one of these two guys, middle-aged, early elderly British man, or an evil robot that wears clothes.
Yeah, it's one of them. But how will we find out?
I hope we figured out this issue. The suspense is killing me.
So the Masters of Evil fly the Avengers to their secret lair in a sweet airship designed by Big John Buscema.
It kind of looks like a flying dog's nose.
Yeah, it's very weird looking. I don't know how it stays up, but Goliath tries to bust out because he's terrible at being a superhero. He gets gassed by the Crimson Cowl. The Cowl insults Claw for nearly allowing the Avengers to escape, and Claw responds by blasting him with a powerful sonic wave. But it doesn't even phase the Cowl. That could be a hint.
Yeah, I was going to say, my money is now no longer on the early elderly British man.
Yeah. This is when the Cowl reveals the plan. He's going to stick the Avengers inside of a hydrogen bomb and suspend it above the Empire State Building.
People are so worried about the vibro bomb, the seismo bomb.
Yeah.
They're not even going to pay attention to this fucking H bomb, you guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's big enough to put some people in, but still, it's just an H bomb.
The seismo bomb just fits in an attaché case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, psychologically, humanity can only worry about one bomb at a time. That's a fact. So
that's science. So if the authorities don't give into the Cowl's demands, he'll, of course, detonate it, killing the Avengers and everybody in New York City. If they do, then he'll just dump it in the ocean and drown the Avengers. They can just drown in a bomb that doesn't detonate. So
yep. You cannot lose.
It's win-win for the Crimson Cowl.
Yeah.
He's playing with house money.
Yeah. Either way, we're walking out of here with dead Avengers.
Yeah. We covered our bets. Before he gets the plan in action, he reveals that he still has Jarvis held prisoner and under hypnosis. So probably not Jarvis in that robe. I mean, I'm not a science man like Brian, but I'm saying not Jarvis.
It feels pretty definitive. At this point, it'd have to be a real switcheroo.
Which, I mean, don't put it past Roy. He would come up
Jarvis.
With
Scooby-Doo.
Ultron. Double Scooby-Doo. We pulled the double do at the end. It's amazing.
I'm still thinking of Double Do Claw from your new dog.
So cute.
I'm going to just say Double Do Claw all day, but that's going to be my new Yabba Dabba Do, which wasn't a thing for me, but now it is. So Jarvis remembers giving the cow the plans to Avengers Mansion because he believed there was no way the Avengers would lose. So he was like, you know, I'm going to make a little extra money and the Avengers are going to win anyway. So
I love that that's the way they try to like make Jarvis appear to not be such a bad guy. It's like, I did give all the blueprints to the mansion to a group of your worst enemies because I thought you'd probably win.
Yeah.
Also, why would you be dumb enough to put all of your blueprints so easily accessible? Surely there's got to be some secret that's not on these blueprints, right?
Yeah.
No? Oh, it's just all written down here. How very fastidious of you.
Yeah. It's the 90th time villains have broken into Avengers Mansion.
I tell you, Tony Stark left that team and everything just went to hell.
Yeah. He was the security dude.
Yep.
So Jarvis disguised himself as the Crimson Cal, but it was not, but it was just the ruse all along. The real Crimson Cal is Ultron 5, not just Ultron 1, also known as the Living Automaton. So, under Ultron 5's orders, the ye old melter gets rid of Jarvis by taking him out of the lair and then brings a ton of debris down around him. He doesn't
proving
melt
definitively
him.
That Jarvis is unmeltable.
True.
Right.
He chose to knock stuff on him instead of attempting. Maybe Jarvis doesn't have
and
human flesh.
It's good enough. He literally I dispose of him. This is just as good as melting.
Yeah. He's not a details guy. And, yeah, he probably had
he's
the melting
not
gun.
Not a detailed guy. Listen, Melter's a big picture thinker. Okay,
yeah,
you got to get granular. You got to get yourself a claw in there.
Yeah.
You got to get yourself a whirlwind.
I think he just had the gun set to stone chimney instead of human, and
yeah, just like, pick what it's set for. You don't want to change the setting right now. It's just too much busy work. But but Jarvis survives. And he stumbles through an alleyway until he encounters secret good guy, the Black Knight. So the Black Knight flies his Pegasus, Aragorn, to the Empire State Building and attacks the Masters of Evil ship, freeing the Avengers. They make short work of the Masters of Evil, minus Ultron 5, who's watching the debacle from a second secret lair.
He's got another secret lair.
He's got a backup secret lair.
Yeah.
Already in the Avengers, the Avengers have a secret lair? Check the blueprints. Nope, no secret lair. Great. Does Ultron have a secret lair? Check the blueprints. We didn't have blueprints. Then there's got to be a secret lair.
At least three. So when the fight is over, the Black Knight tells them not to judge Jarvis too harshly. Jarvis reveals that his mother had been ill for months and he needed money for the treatments to cure her, which he didn't mention to anybody. He's proud. He's very proud.
He works for like the richest guy in America.
Yeah.
And has been for decades and didn't think to is that he would betray the Avengers before he asked Tony Stark for a loan.
Yeah.
It's such a weird, it's also a very Marvel specific trope. I was doing it for my sick mother.
Yeah. So that's his motivation. He offers to turn himself in. The Avengers tell him that risking his life for them made up for betraying them, so all is forgiven. Yeah, there you go. Just one question remains. Who is Ultron 5, and why does he want to destroy them? We have no idea, but from his other secret lair, just the second secret lair, Ultron 5 assures us that the Avengers shall all die by his hand. The end.
The end.
It's weird that Melter couldn't melt a horse.
Yep.
I think Claw referring to himself as the Sultan of Sound is lame because it's like trying to give yourself a nickname.
Yep.
I love that Hawkeye unsurprisingly is unconscious when we see it. For most of the issue, Hawkeye is unconscious.
Yep.
I wrote this down. At one point, someone has a line, revenge comes first, then comes power. And in my notes, I wrote, then comes Melter to the baby shower. And also, Ultron refers, I believe Ultron refers to Claw, or someone refers to some of the phrase jungle bred friend. is used. So the Avengers are canceled.
Yep.
That is true.
There was, there that, was some... that was a breathtaking moment of whoa.
Yes. No.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Of course you're evil, Ultron.
If you've been programmed to say stuff like that, you are evil. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm only as I have been programmed. Hey, racist.
Ultron 5, the most racist of robots. Yeah.
Five times the racism.
Yeah.
Five times the racism of my predecessors.
Oh.
So if at the end of WandaVision, there's not a traitorous butler, I'm fucking heavy.
Yeah. Come on.
Yep. Yeah. So that's it. That's the comics for the month. Why don't we talk about things that aren't necessarily comics from June of 1968 for our recommendations?
Oh, that'll be novel.
Yeah.
Haven't done that at all. This week I'm going to recommend another podcast that I think our listeners might be interested in. It is Voice of Latveria by our friend and frequent guest Douglas Wolk. He has written a book called All of the Marvels, which is coming out later this year, about reading 27,000 Marvel comics, which is more than five times as many comic books as drove the Flaming Carrot insane. Voice of Latveria is an in-character exploration of every one of Doctor Doom's appearances in chronological order. As we record this, the first couple of episodes have hit the pod waves. They are great. So search for Voice of Latveria wherever you get your podcasts.
It's got a great intro. It's just so set in that world. So just that little premise makes it worth listening to.
Yeah.
For me, I'm going with something that is actually Marvel this time. Shuri, The Search for the Black Panther, is a collection of the first solo Shuri books. It's written by Nnedi Okorafor, so sorry I said that wrong for sure, who is worth checking out for a lot of other excellent sci-fi and much more, with great art by Leonardo Romero. It covers the time when T'Challa has been lost in a remote galaxy and someone needs to step up and do both a role as ruler and the Panther. And if you love this character in the Black Panther movie and the Avengers movies, which I very much did, you will love this. It is also, it's just very much that character. It'll be good reading for the future of the Black Panther. It could be in film and television. I'm sure that this character will be part of the MCU. We'll see though. That's just me throwing it out there. All this stuff is also available in monthly issues on the Marvel Unlimited app. So I don't know. I feel like we plug them all day long, but I mean, yeah. That's how we read this stuff.
Yep. We should be getting kickbacks. Matt, you got anything to recommend this month?
Yeah. You know, Gilbert Hernandez has been on a crazy, crazy hot streak. There's a story called Little Ones in this issue called Psycho, a standalone issue called Psychodrama Illustrated. I think that maybe one of the best things he's ever done. And then it's kind of ongoing series of, you know, the character Fritzy has this history of being a B-movie actress. And he has made graphic novels that are the B-movie she starred in. And one came out a couple weeks ago. It's actually a flip book. It's two in one. And it's just the breadth of work out of this guy at a given time is never not remarkable. And it's been really terrific. Comic wise, it's been my favorite thing the last couple of weeks that I've encountered.
Nice.
Sweet.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Gilbert
Hernandez, he's pretty good.
He's pretty good. You heard it here first. Well, Matt, it is always a delight to have you on the show. Thank you so much for doing this with us once again.
This has kept me going through core. This has been so much fun. I never don't enjoy this. It's like the best. Like I got homework I got to do. I have to read these comics just for work. I love it. Thank you for indulging my every meandering cul-de-sac and whim of thought as we have went through this amazing month of Marvel books together.
Yeah.
Well, of all the things you could be doing with your considerable talents, I can't believe that this is what you are doing, but we're very grateful for it.
Revenge comes first, then comes power, then comes melting a baby shower. There's no off position on the genius switch, boys. Volume.
Is there anything that we can plug for you? November 4 just came out, so
that's out.
Yeah,
that'd be good if you go and read November. There's four graphic novels, novellas that form a big story. They're I think $16 a pop, and then beautiful little 80-page graphic novellas, and forms a great big fat story when you read them all together. Me and Elsa Chartier did that, and nope, that's it. That's all I got. That's what's happened. That's it. I'm officially out of books.
Right on. Well,
Go read Psychodrama number 3 by Gilbert.
Right.
Psychodrama, whatever it is, Psychodrama Illustrated number 3 or something absurd like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm so looking forward to just sitting down with the whole stack of Novembers and reading them.
I'd be fascinated to hear what you think.
Yeah.
I hope it works.
Yeah. Well, the after I read the first one, I felt like it had that good Stray Bullets energy, which is one of my, that might be my favorite comic of all time. So it is, it's
huge influence on me. Thank you. That's. I don't know that we were served by publishing it in 4 volumes, but then again, I also don't know that that plan was aided by the pandemic destroying because it was supposed to come out in November.
Yeah.
It was going to be November, every was like that.
Here we are. I also have a Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, on the top of my, stack after I get through the third book of November. So you are, you're in the pile.
All right.
To sit in X rolling too by the Panda Brothers, most of the way through that. So just keep a few things going, but yeah, thank you for entertaining me during COVID, both here and in your writing.
Yeah, my pleasure. And Jimmy was the book where the end especially was a response to COVID. It was, I don't want to blow it for you. I don't want to lay it blow it for you, but you'll find it as you find it. But the ending went way up to 11 just explicitly I went full Blazing Saddles at the end, and it was a deliberate I need Blazing Saddles. I am taking this full Blazing Saddles.
Nice.
That's where we end. So that's definitely a pandemic book in my head.
I look forward to it even more now. And Brian sold it to me so hard that I had to order it.
Thank you. And listen, fuck my shit. Steve Lieber is amazing, and he's one of the most versatile guys, and he does it all and makes it look so effortless, and it's so funny, and he's so good. Just for Steve's work alone is working with him is a dream. Here's the thing. I think I could say this. I'm doing a story in the Old Guard anthology series that's coming up, but Steve is going to draw that. We did kind of a quasi-Western. So
nice. Very cool.
Steve working together again on an Old Guard story. I think that'll be out. It'll be out in the future. It'll be out when my dog is the size of a large dog.
Well, we got to wrap this up. Hey, leave us an Apple Podcast review if you would be so nice, or review us on any podcast service that would allow you to review us. And if you want some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of it to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth, and marvelbythemonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. Until next week, when we come back and do this all again, my name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And please stay safe, stay healthy, stay inside, and read comics.
Revenge comes first, then comes power, then comes Melter in the baby shower.
I'm not going to be able to look at that character again without that being in my head.
Oh, no. Did I ruin the Melter?
I know.